I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we talk about depression and treatments, and joining us is psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Mindy.
You know, I thought I would start with statistics about how many people, you know, but it's the numbers really are deceiving because they're probably much higher than what we think they are.
Sure. And they've become higher as time, you know, in more recent time. There's all sorts of arguments or issues about why that is so, but it is the case. The statistic that sticks in my mind that I kind of use as a take home is that approximately 1 out of 5 people at some point, that's 20%, at some point in their life will experience a major depressive episode that could be diagnosed as such. Mm-hmm. Or they'll meet the criteria, just about 20%. That's very, very frequent for a diagnosis of any condition in life. And the other statistic that's emerging in supposedly about 10 years or so, it's going to become the leading cause of disability or illness burden in the world, really, mm-hmm. Beyond other things. So it's a condition that really affects human beings, human interactions, and human functioning. Mm-hmm. It's not just a sad mood.
Right.
We can talk about the criteria, but it becomes a major depression when it is something that really affects functioning and impairs the person in the spheres of family interactions, work, study, whatever. Mm-hmm. And of course, it can be fatal. That's the other attention-grabbing aspect of it.
When you say fatal, you mean suicide?
Suicide.
Yeah. Was it between 2% and 8% of adults with major disease die by suicide,
right.
Major depression. So I guess we should start with, you're talking about major depression, and you kind of mentioned, you know, being sad or blue. So there's a lot of varying degrees of depression, right? I mean, I think, you know, Dr. Mike, who can't be with us this morning, describes it as like a 6-lane highway.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. And there are obviously different severity of the condition. And we have the field has come to agreement basically on a number of features that if you have I think it's 4 of them, isn't it, that you do qualify for a diagnosis of major depression if you've had these features for more than a couple of weeks. So it's not a temporary thing. But the features have to do with sleep problems. You no longer have interest in usual activities. You might feel guilty. Low energy is very common. Poor concentration. Appetite disturbances. Sometimes your mind is slow or your movements are slow, and you can almost tell somebody who is depressed by their body mm-hmm. posture and how they move. And then, of course, suicidal ideation. If you have any of those features to a degree that does get in your way, then you probably have a major depression. And there can be variations on that. Irritability is another one that is very frequent. Anxiety also. Mm-hmm. So it covers a pretty wide ground, but at least in terms of making a diagnosis so that you should have treatment, we stick with the criteria that we've kind of agreed about.
The conversation that I find myself often having with patients, and often it's at their initiative, is the distinction between what we historically call dysthymia and versus major depression. So dysthymic disorder or dysthymia is a mild to moderate degree of depression, which does not prevent you from functioning, from getting up every day and doing what you have to do, but does prevent you from experiencing significant amount of joy in your life. Mm-hmm. So you kind of, you know, you kind of go along, but without really enjoying the benefits of a positive experience in life. Whereas a major depression disorder, you know, what Mark is referring to is primarily a degree of injury or of hurt of symptoms that really do interfere with your ability to get up, to function, to work productively. You mentioned concentration, for example, as one of many symptoms. And I find that when I'm seeing people who are unable to work and they're and I'm being asked to fill out disability paperwork or FMLA paperwork, it's the inability to concentrate as well as the lack of motivation,
right,
which are two of the primary interferences with going to work, being at work, doing an adequate job. You know, if you can probably function decently in the workplace if you're not eating properly or if you're overeating, even if you feel like crying frequently, again, one of the common symptoms of major depression, you probably could function. But if you can't focus, if you can't concentrate, if you're completely lacking in motivation, if you feel like someone just took half the air out of your tires, it's really difficult to just get yourself to go to work and do the job you're being paid to do.
Right. And there are other cognitive functions that get impaired too. People don't remember well. They can't figure out problems because their mind is just jumbled in a way. And they can, with treatment, improve in terms of their mood and their outlook, but they can still retain some difficulties with thinking. That research is showing that now. So in terms of what we call remission from depression, we need to look at how well the person is thinking in addition to functioning. That a lot goes into a successful treatment that sometimes we overlook and let slide.
And I think also when you think about treatment, you know, once you've kind of thought through what are the symptoms, what is the correct diagnosis, the treatment algorithm also, you know, hinges on that. So, for example, if a person is dysthymic, if they're able to function but they're not experiencing joy, whether it's because they're in a bad relationship or they can't stand their boss or they have an illness, a chronic back pain might be an example. Psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapies, often non-pharmacologic therapies are the treatment, the first choice for treatment. When somebody's not able to go to work, when they're disabled, or, for example, a college student who's not going to classes or staying in their classroom, you know, that degree of disability, to me, that's where we need to, you know, call in the troops and recommend both medication and psychotherapy or cognitive behavioral therapy of one sort or another at the same time.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, also thinking of the stigma, you know, people say, what's wrong with you? You have a good job, you have a nice family, you know, what have you got to be depressed about? I mean, you hear that a lot. And people might say that to themselves. Why do I feel so sad? I have a great job, I have a great family. Everything,
all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
So it's sort of this feeling, but with no real, there's a reason, but it isn't obvious.
That's right. Well, there could be a reason in the environment, and there also is a reason simply in the brain, that a different mental state sets in. I've heard it described as a window shade coming down. People might feel okay, and then a few minutes later, it's like a window shade, and it just comes down, and everything is dark. All thoughts, all rumination is negative. This is really where the rubber meets the road in terms of biology and environment, there is definitely a mental state that gets induced, I think, purely on majorly on a biological route. And then the person is trying to sort out their environment, which they can't cope with because they're not on all eight cylinders or all six cylinders. So it's it really is a mixture of what goes on in one's life and what has gone on in one's life in the past, and how their brain is functioning. And we're getting to the point, I think, in years to come that we'll have some real biological markers in terms of genes that are convey a high risk to depression. And perhaps the hope would be that we would have some treatments directed at those genes or the products of those genes to modify the disorder and modify the course of it.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. The cause, we don't really know, but we know there's a genetic component. You're saying it could be environmental. Could it be diet? I mean, it could be a whole bunch of different things, right?
Sure,
I mean,
it could be medical conditions. Supposedly, genetics. I don't know how they get this percentage, but genetics contribute about 40% of the cause. So it's a big one.
Yeah.
Obviously, people get depressed in relationship to loss and stress, feeling helpless, being in helpless situations.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of the chronic. When you talk about the, like chronic back pain or migraines. I mean, there's all kinds of physical. I could see where you'd be depressed. You know, you can't get up and function as you normally would. And,
well, pain is a very, very important cause of depression, particularly in elderly people, mm-hmm. and we see it all the time in practice for mm-hmm. sure. Regarding the causes, there are the genetic causes. In the old days, again, I'm referring back to, when Mark and I probably were in training at more or less the same time, our teachers, made the distinction between exogenous and endogenous depression.
Right.
So an exogenous depression was, if your house just burned down, you'd have a good reason to be depressed. Mm-hmm. But if you had no good reason, it's such as the person that you referred to earlier, good family, good job, happy marriage, and yet there's depression. So that's what you would call an endogenous depression. And even now, even today, there are some people, in fact, I dare say a lot of physicians, think that, well, if you have a good reason to be depressed because you just, your wife just walked out on you or whatever, that's not the sort of depression that would be likely to respond to medication. Well, this is foolishness.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, responses to treatment are not particularly there's no known correlation between choice of treatment and what the identified cause is, unless you can, obviously, if you can identify a specific cause for depression and you can take care of that cause, that's certainly going to help along the way.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
So according to the National Institute of Mental Health, women are 70% more likely than men to experience depression during the course of their lifetimes. Now, research has shown this is partly due to hormones. Makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. But is it also because women may be more likely to seek help and be diagnosed than men?
Oh, I'm sure. Yes, that's definitely a factor. Women are much more relational and more insightful, really, than men in general, who in our culture, at least, the male is encouraged to be strong, not weak in terms of, in other words, succumbing, quote, unquote, to emotions is a weakness and to be avoided.
Well, men know more about football, but women know more about themselves.
Yeah,
it's a trade-off.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You can't know everything.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what gets the attention. Yes, so there's cultural factors, obviously, that play a part there. When you say it's hormones, it's not just the fact of hormones are different in women. It's a change of hormones.
Right, right.
The brain is bathed in different hormones at different times of the month. Males don't have to cope with that.
Mm-hmm. We're still very, very early on in understanding the relationship between hormones and changes in hormones and psychological illnesses. Here in Boston, we have now at Mass General a Department of Reproductive Psychiatry that really focuses on that interface, and I believe Brigham and Women's may have one mm-hmm. as well. But we're still so early on. We're probably sort of like where cancer treatment was 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
We're just really scratching the surface. And patients will often ask about is this hormones or talking about premenstrual.
Postpartum depression,
postpartum and peripartum, and yet we just don't know the fact. We just don't have the facts.
And how frustrating to be going through that. I feel so bad for women who go through postpartum depression because you've got that added pressure. So this is supposed to be a happy time in your life, but you're not feeling very happy, and then you're feeling guilty about not feeling happy, and
sure.
It's sort of this double-edged sword.
Absolutely.
I was having a conversation with a OBGYN nurse practitioner a couple of months ago, and I said, in 35 years of practice, I have not received a single referral by an OBGYN for postpartum depression, which I just think is weird because there are very few psychiatrists in New Bedford.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She said, well, because in her experience, most obstetricians their view is kind of not very psychiatric. It's, you know, well, yeah, you know, this happens. Just, you know, get on, take care of your baby. Everything will be okay. But we know that for a lot of women, it doesn't. It's not okay.
Yeah. Right.
And sometimes it can be a real disaster.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more about depression after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about depression and treatments with psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz and the psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so treatments. There's a lot of different ways. You mentioned earlier if it's not a major depression, maybe it's just, you know, cognitive therapy.
Or talking.
And so what are our options?
But the broad options are biological treatment that somehow does something to the brain to change its functioning, to jar it a bit. And you have a whole host of things there. You have certainly the medications, but you also have surgery, actually. You have electroshock therapy that is commonly is fairly commonly used. And Dr. Schwartz will fill us in on the more recent one, which is magnetic therapy, which is much more user-friendly and can be quite effective. So those are the biological interventions. And then the psychological ones, quote, talking therapies, have all sorts of forms and shapes, group therapy, individual therapy, couples, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think the takeaway message is use whatever works and in combination.
Before we get to the TMS, I want to mention, you said shock therapy. And I think people have they go, whoa, shock therapy. You know, we see, right, you know, horror movies made. But Kitty Dukakis wrote a really good book. And if I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head right now, but she talked about her experience, which actually worked for her.
Yep.
And I thought she was very brave in how forthcoming she was. I don't know if either of you read that book, but it really gave you a window into what it's like to suffer from that.
Yeah. ECT has a, as you say, a horrible reputation. Mostly Jack Nicholson did a great disservice to it. And in truly, in the early days of ECT, which you're talking about 40, 50, 60 years ago, in the early days, just as in the early days of almost any therapeutic approach, docs were still trying to figure out how to get it right. But today, by and large, they really do have it down really well, and it is a very, very powerful, very effective treatment for the large majority of people who have a severe depression. Mm-hmm. People are understandably scared of it, mm-hmm, because a certain percentage of people will have some memory loss, will have some confusion, and it's certainly not going to be used unless somebody really does have a profound depression that has failed to respond to
virtually every other
treatment. But it's not something that people should be... It should be wary of it, but not afraid of it. And, mm-hmm, and for if you have a family member or you yourself have had a severe depression that has not responded to anything, you do yourself a favor and at least have a consultation with somebody who is a specialist in that.
Exactly. Yeah. It can be life-saving, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've seen it turn people around in an amazing way like you say, when other things have not worked. It's also the treatment of choice, really, with a very older person who becomes depressed and it's perhaps psychotic. And usually they don't respond too well to medications a lot of times, but ECT will turn it around within a week or two.
All right. Let's talk to Melissa, who's giving us a call from Wareham. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
Hi,
thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to talk about some of the other issues that tie into depression. I saw a therapist for years trying to treat my depression, and it wasn't until I sort of uncovered that underlying the depression was a pretty serious eating disorder that I was really able to come to terms with my depression and find my way into recovery. And I just find that most of the people I talk to who are experiencing depression have something else going on, either childhood trauma or, something like an eating disorder. And it seems that that's true at a cultural level, too. It's a very timely discussion, and I just had a conversation with my nephew, I think, on Monday, where he said that in his generation, maybe 25% experience depression. He thinks those numbers are seriously underreported, especially for boys and men. And it seems like there's so much cultural pressure on us, and we're also isolated now. It just seems like it's more than just a chemical thing or genetic thing, that there's actually something going on socially.
Yeah, good, really good points, Melissa. And she brings up a really good point about underlying conditions, because a lot of people, I can't remember the percentage, who have depression have anxiety.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's a big, big feature. And I think one common denominator is a sense of helplessness, no matter what the source of the helplessness is. It could be from the past traumas, childhood abuse, et cetera, but also helplessness in advancing your career and being stuck with a bad boy. Any number of things where the emotional experience is a persistent sense and experience of helplessness.
And so what she's talking about culturally, that speaks to the helplessness, doesn't
absolutely.
It? Yeah,
we're all helpless to meet the ideals that our culture seems to demand.
Right. Last month on the show, we talked about the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences, which in many cases, is about abuse or neglect.
Or neglect, yeah.
We found in our TMS practice in New Bedford, which I'll talk about more, many of the people that we're treating with TMS have had lifelong struggles with PTSD based on adverse childhood experiences, most typically abuse, but not always.
All right. So we're mentioning TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. So this is magnetic fields to stimulate nerve cells in the brain, right? So tell us how it works.
So this is a really important discovery or development in the treatment of depression that, I certainly want more people to be aware of because it is now available, in the New Bedford offices. And it offers a very, very different approach to treatment than any of the usual psychopharmacology. Specifically, what TMS does is deliver magnetic pulses of the same sort that are used in MRI, but at a very relatively low kind of frequency, and it stimulates neurons in the prefrontal cortex in the brain, and this results in increased blood flow and increased stimulation of neurons and neurotransmitters in the places that really matter. What's really quite wonderful about this magnetic stimulation is that there are no side effects of the sort that people often experience with the medicines. You take a medicine in your mouth, and the pills, the way they work, whether they're stimulating serotonin or norepinephrine, I mean, they don't really quite know where to go. They go everywhere, and they do a lot of different things. Whereas the magnetic stimulation is a very localized, specific massaging, is the way I think of it, as a kind of a massaging, not to be confused with ECT, with shock therapy, which is a much more violent, although certainly, as we've said, therapeutic intervention. And currently, insurance companies will pay, where they will authorize treatment with TMS if a person has failed on at least 3 or 4 antidepressants. It's unfortunate, and there is the beginnings of a trend of insurance companies maybe not only requiring 1 or 2 failures, and hopefully this trend will continue. And just as there's also a lot of evidence of TMS being effective for actually quite a wide range of disorders, including nicotine addiction, obsessive compulsive disorder, PTSD. But again, these things have not yet been approved. Mm-hmm. This treatment was originally approved 2008 by the FDA. And there have been over 2 million treatments administered by the one company that I use myself. There are a couple of other companies that do manufacture the equipment. But we're learning, again, this is another area in which we're fairly early on in accumulating the data, but we have a huge amount of data about the effectiveness for depression.
So you've been doing it for 2 years?
It'll be 2 years next month.
All right, what is the patient? What are you seeing in your patients?
Well, when I say this, I realize it's almost a little bit hard to believe. But our patient population is people who have failed on at least 4 antidepressants. And in many cases, in almost every case, they have failed on a whole lot more than that and have suffered from severe depression for at least 10 to 15 years, and in many cases, lifelong. So for these people, we're seeing that between 70 and 80% of people are having either a complete remission of depression or at least a 50% improvement,
wow,
as we measure it using a scale that isn't the best scale, but it's the one the insurance companies, you know, require us to use, called the PHQ. So we're seeing about 30, 35% of people having complete remission of depression, which is in itself quite remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the same number having at least enough of an improvement to feel like this was really worthwhile and I would do this again if my depression, if I slipped back into, you know, having a more severe symptoms.
Sure.
So I could see there be, I mean, you hear people say, oh, I don't want to take any drugs. So somebody saying, oh, that sounds great because I don't want to take any drugs, but I have to fail on four before my insurance company will pay for it. So what does it cost if somebody doesn't use their insurance? Is it expensive?
Well, that really depends on where you go, to be honest with you. In our office, you know, we'll sit down with somebody and we'll try to, you know, negotiate a fee that people can pay. But it's going to be at least in the vicinity of $10,000 to $12,000 or up to $14,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
For a course.
For an entire course, which is 36 treatments. Mm-hmm. Each treatment takes approximately 20 minutes. And we were talking about ECT before, and not only how effective it is, but also how afraid people are.
Mm-hmm.
And people often will ask, well, you know, do you have trouble getting people to come, you know, every day, 5 days a week for 6 weeks and so on for these treatments? And my response is this. When people have failed on multiple treatments and they're really looking down the barrel of ECT because that's really the next option, mm-hmm, for them, it's remarkable how motivated they are, mm-hmm, to come. Mm-hmm. And really, people come. I mean, we haven't had a single person drop out because they just couldn't stand, mm-hmm, the – and we have people coming from Dennisport, Harwich, Yarmouth, Falmouth, even in the summer,
yeah,
even with all the traffic. I feel terrible for people having to map out their day in that way.
But when you think about that, if you've been through a number of medications and you've really been struggling this for some time and you're doing something that's working, you know, I could see where, why would you want to stop that?
Yeah. People are welcome to go to our website, which is tmsnewbedford.com, mm-hmm, and learn more about it.
Is there anybody in the Cape doing? I mean, it's not as well utilized here, right, than it is in the rest of the country?
There is no TMS machine on the Cape. We actually had begun to have a conversation about maybe having one here, either, mm-hmm, in Hyannis or Bourne or someplace that would be, you know, handier for people, but, mm-hmm, it hasn't happened yet.
But it is being used nationwide, though, more so in other areas.
Oh, it's remarkable. We were at a meeting a few months ago and met people and heard people speaking who have multiple TMS clinics in Florida, California, New York, New England, as is perhaps predictable, has been slower to catch on. Academically, there are a lot of machines in New England that are being used for research. Butler Hospital in Providence has several machines. Mass General has machines. Beth Israel in Boston has a machine. So it's not that the technology is not being accepted on an academic level by the Ivory Tower folks, but in the communities, it has been slower.
Yeah. So looking at the results you've had with your patients, and certainly I'm sure there are studies nationwide going on of the effectiveness of this. Do we know, I mean, is there, in, you know, 2008, that's not really all that long ago. Do we know, do we have any studies that are mirroring what you're seeing?
Oh, absolutely. What the statistics I gave you absolutely mirrors the national data.
Mm, yeah. Interesting.
Could you say what the patient actually experiences when they go in? Happens.
Sure. People come in, they're lying back or sitting back really in a chair that's a very comfortable chair. I think that
like a dental chair or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Like a spa chair or a dental chair.
I was picturing a lazy boy. But
yeah,
okay.
That's right. Yeah. It's not maybe quite so plush, but still very comfortable. And this sort of housing that has the coil in it basically just rests on your scalp. Mm-hmm. And initially, it's uncomfortable. It feels like there's a woodpecker tapping on the top of your head, and that is the single most commonly used description that patients have. And there's some noise associated with it. Typically, it's not loud, but it's a noise much quieter than an MRI machine typically is. And so that is the one sort of somatic or physical side effect that people might experience, is that discomfort, mm-hmm, at first. But people routinely, they lose the sensitivity, you know, as we might expect, as their scalp the sensory nerves kind of become immune to it, if not by the end of the first treatment, by the end of the first week. And again, not a single person has stopped treatment because they found the discomfort unbearable. You know, we're able to move the position of the coil a little here and a little there if people are uncomfortable. And this is actually one of the benefits. As I mentioned, there's a few different companies that make the machines. The one that we use is NeuroStar. Which was the one that was first approved by the FDA. It's the only company that's actually submitted large amounts of data and clinical trials. And we have the ability to move the machine around if somebody is uncomfortable to try to help solve that problem.
And the person doesn't fall asleep.
We prefer if people don't fall asleep. We actually have we have a TV. If you want to watch movies or a television show, you can do that. But part of what seems to be helpful, and this is not, again, this is not science, this is empirical, is there's a technician in the room at all times. A person is never alone during a TMS treatment. And again, we're talking about people who have had a long history of depression. And for many people, the relationship that they form with the technician is a really interesting part of what happens. Of course, we can't measure, well, to what degree is that relationship part of actually what's helping their depression improve? But for many of these people, they don't have much in the, you know, that's certainly not true for, but for a certain portion of the people, they're pretty isolated, right? as you would expect. And they have these relationships which actually continue beyond the end of the treatment. Having a good technician, and we have two very good technicians, having a good technician, I think, is really key.
And then for the rest of the day, they can drive, for instance?
Absolutely.
They can do whatever they want.
People drive to the treatment. They leave from the treatment. They're welcome to bring their children. We had one, we treated one 18-year-old fellow, and his mom came, and she actually videotaped the session, which was fine. We also invite people who are thinking about having TMS to come and actually observe a treatment and talk with people who are receiving the treatment.
That's great.
That's great to make you feel comfortable.
It took me 2 years to sort of decide to actually make the investment, having previously only invested in a ballpoint pen. That's probably my most one of the nice things about being a psychiatrist is you don't have a lot of capital equipment. So it took me 2 years to kind of figure out that A, this treatment works, and B, it makes sense for me to have it there in the office.
Your figures are very impressive.
It's better
than what I've heard in the past, so I'm glad you're getting your message out.
What about neurofeedback? That's another option.
Oh, that would be another biological intervention, at least that partially uses biology. That is done in different ways too, but basically the person is given some feedback about how their brain is functioning, and they use some mental exercises to try to match what they're experiencing inside with whatever changes in terms of measurement. It could be changes in brain waves, or a really a fancy one is it's been known that people who have depression have one biological marker is that their amygdalas, which are the part of the brain that governs emotion, the people that have depression, when they're thinking about something positive, the amygdala doesn't get activated. There's less blood flow. So there's been at least one study using neurofeedback to treat depression by increasing the blood flow to the amygdala. Okay, yeah, you got a picture of it there. And that you can maybe mention that as a target for the TMS too. By the person, they coach the person while they're having the procedure, the functional MRI, which actually just is a way of visualizing blood flow, increase, decrease, change. They coach them to remember positive experiences, emotional experiences, autobiographical experiences, and coach them to keep focusing on that. And they'll notice some increase in the amygdala, and then they're coached to make that better, make that better, keep doing that. The point being that after the after several sessions of this, their depression improved. To a significant degree. It's a treatment.
It's really a form of brain training.
Yes,
and there are several other types of brain training, but and really what you're doing is you're actually able, if whether you're using an EEG or some other form of, you're able to actually see how your EEG changes as you get better at whatever the procedure is. This, at least 40 years ago, studies that traced EEG changes in people who meditate.
Right.
And it's not so different from that. But
no.
This is maybe a little bit more concrete in a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we know that meditation is a very, very powerful treatment, especially for anxiety disorders of all kinds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's in itself a form of brain training.
Yeah, absolutely. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about depression and treatments with psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Or our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Witt writes, just tuned in. Have you mentioned or will you the very promising work using psilocybin and other related compounds? Michael Pollan will be speaking here on The Vineyard on Sunday about his new book, which goes into depth on these treatments. Thoughts on that?
I don't know much about it directly, other than, yes, it is something that has surfaced recently and has been shown to alter mood. And sometimes it's reported, at least, in a profound way. When I hear about it, I think about it being used in terminal illness, hospice patients, as being quite useful in helping them come to terms emotionally with what they're experiencing. But I have a very purely surface notion, knowledge of it.
Yeah, and what I know is mostly based on Terry Gross's interview on Fresh Air of Michael recently on his new book. And I would encourage anybody to go and listen to him because he's really fabulous. Certainly in the interview, what he speaks mostly about is the use of these hallucinogenics to help people who are struggling with a terminal illness or with some very deep sadness that's been difficult to articulate and to sort of process.
PTSD.
I don't know about its use or what the opportunity is in sort of what we might call everyday depression.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think we're still a little bit early on, but I would encourage anybody to pick up the book.
One of the things that is a corollary to this is the use of ketamine for depression. That has hit the headlines in recent years. Ketamine is a anesthetic that is also a hallucinogen, and it used on the street. It used to be called vitamin K, or still is, I guess, because it's
special
kind of,
K.
Special K. That's right.
Yeah.
Because it produces hallucinogens. At any rate, it's been shown, and whether it really holds up is another question, but it's been shown to really reverse depression with one infusion. The people walk in, sit down, get connected to an IV, can walk away without their depression symptoms that might last a day or two or a week. It varies. So that's something that's coming down the pike, too, about now the drug companies are looking for a more user-friendly way of administering it and whether it really works as well as other things.
Right.
Question to be resolved.
Mary has a good question. She says, TMS sounds great, but with the motivation due to history of failed treatments, fear of shock therapy, and patients with high investment in the therapy of daily travel for treatment, I wonder how much of a placebo effect is at work. Are there good data measuring this? And thanks for the discussion.
An excellent question. Actually, in the data that was originally presented to the FDA, this was a controlled trial where there was a sham treatment compared to the effective. So sham treatment is essentially the same as a placebo, where a person is sitting in the chair and the coil is sitting on their head and perhaps the noise occurs as well. But there's no actual magnetic pulse that is being administered that would have a, you know, snowball's chance of being effective. And the separation between response to placebo, the sham treatment, and response to the actual TMS was very large, much larger than the difference between pills, placebo pills, and antidepressant medication.
Wow.
So even though the FDA, of course, has approved many, many antidepressants, and we use them routinely, and they do work for a lot of people, the difference in response between placebo and the antidepressants that we have at our command is much narrower than the difference between actual TMS and sham.
Wow, that's really great question, Mary. Thanks for that. So we haven't talked about the connection with depression and inflammation. This is, boy, inflammation comes up a lot.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere, yeah.
That's right. Yeah, this is something that's been developed in the last, 10, 15 years or so, looking at inflammation as a an associated aspect of all sorts of mental disorders. Some of you, one extreme example was the condition that was described in the film in the book called Brain on Fire, where a journalist became psychotic very abruptly and was misdiagnosed for a number of months. And finally, it was determined that she had a kind of an autoimmune disease where antibodies were attacking receptor sites in her brain. And it's a rare condition, but it is clearly an example of an inflammatory process causing a mental disorder very directly. But it's also being implicated in depression in general. And you can imagine why this would be so. When somebody is depressed, we didn't get into this, but there are all sorts of chemical changes in the brain in terms of hormones and cortisol, which is one of the hormones that influences inflammation. There's all sorts of changes. So the brain is bathed in a stressed kind of chemical environmental state. Stress brings on, so that in itself brings on inflammation, which inflammation is just the overreaction of our immune system against what the immune system perceives as an enemy, commonly bacteria, keeps us alive, or viruses. But it can attack anything that is out of the ordinary. So it makes sense then that inflammatory processes could be involved in at least stress-induced psychiatric conditions, and probably beyond that too. And then also things like Alzheimer's disease, also involved inflammation,
big part of that.
So it would be nice if we could really influence that and make a change in the inflammatory excess in the brain that is accompanying depression, PTSD, stress-related conditions, and there are some things that can help. They're starting to be used more, but you can't. One thing that you can't just take an Advil and expect it, your depression to go away. There are other agents that can be anti-inflammatory and be adjuncts to other. Other antidepressant treatments.
In my mind, as you're saying this, I'm going diet.
Yeah,
I mean, that would be a big one. I mean, that's something you're not taking a pill. It's like you're just paying attention to what foods cause more inflammation than others, right?
Exercise reduces inflammation.
Adequate sleep.
Sleep's
very
a big
important.
One, yeah.
Yeah. I think eliminating all the stress in your life is a great thing. That's really what everybody should do.
That's
right away.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, right.
Although you mentioned this earlier, a meditation, it's amazing how, and the whole mindfulness movement now, which is similar to meditation and diet. I mean, you can really do a lot just yourself in changing your own lifestyle habits, which is very difficult for a lot of people to do.
Which biologically means that you're reducing inflammation. And that's one of the avenues to improvement.
Mark, you commented or you referred to some statistics that separate rates of depression in different countries, France and Japan were two that you mentioned. Yeah. And, one has to wonder, why would the rate of depression, there are some sort of silly answers that it may be easy to come by, but it's really not that easy to understand why the rate of depression would be different in one country or another.
But it is.
Any thoughts about why that might be?
Well, one broad statement is that in the developed countries, the rate of depression is higher than in the countries that are either undeveloped or developing. That just brings to my mind, at least, the common sense notion that when you're struggling for getting food every day and, basic needs, your mind doesn't ruminate so much about what's wrong. Mm-hmm. You're focused to survive. And I think that's more of a daily experience in the developing world than it is in our world, where everything kind of comes very easy in general. Mm-hmm. So therefore, any depression is sort of just not noticed because it gets in the way.
We have time to think about things.
Yes, we have too much time to.
Another thing we haven't talked about is, we're talking about depression and the impact on the person with depression, but it impacts the whole family. In a big way.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. And you know that, Mindy, that one of my favorite themes is that families that stick together experience less stress, and that we live – the more developed countries are the countries in which kids are more likely to leave home and travel far away and find a job 1,000 miles away or go to college 2,000 miles away. In older, less developed countries where people don't have so much money, there's not so much infrastructure, it's not that easy to, people that don't – multiple generations continue to live together in the same village, even in the same home. I personally believe that that's a huge factor in health and welfare of people.
Social ties.
Community, the sense of community.
Yeah. Right. And I'm just thinking, and I know I've shared this before, my mother suffered from depression. And I can remember as a kid, not knowing what you're going to come home, kind of walking on eggshells. Is she going to be in a good mood or not so good mood? And not really as a young kid. First time I ever heard the word, I think, I don't remember how old I was. I was a kid and she was sad. And I said, what's wrong? She said that she was depressed. And I said, I don't know what that is. I cannot remember what her explanation of it was, but I remember it sounding really bad. Yeah. That one. I said, I don't think I've ever been depressed. And the way she said, and I hope you never do. I was like, oh boy, this whatever it is really bad.
Yeah, it's been described as an inscrutable pain.
Yeah.
Even though that goes beyond physical pain, that is just really unbearable. William Styron wrote that book, In the Darkness, which really was described it very well, and he's been called the God of Depression in a way by making it so. Accessible, or at least the inner experience, so vivid.
Yeah. Let's talk to Jane, who's calling from Barnstable. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I've enjoyed your discussion very much. I'm a physician. I've had a career in the Air Force, and I'm getting ready to certify in lifestyle medicine, which is very focused on lifestyle approaches to prevention and treatment. I wondered if you would comment on the role of exercise. Many of us in this society, unfortunately, are very sedentary, and I know at least I believe some psychologists use walking therapy, even with their patients, to try to add that to the mix of treatment. And in particular, I've been fascinated by John Rady's book about exercise in the brain. Mm-hmm. Also, I wondered if you'd mention anything you know about acupuncture being used in this setting. And thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane, for the call.
Thanks. I don't know much about or anything really about acupuncture being applied, but exercise, I always thought I was successful with patients when I got them to exercise. Mm-hmm. And I nag people about it day in and day out. My own experience was if I exercised, I simply felt better, more sharp, better functioning and happier.
There's no question that the human body was designed to move.
Yes.
It wasn't designed to be sedentary. We didn't have these Herman Miller Aeron chairs back before the wheel.
Right.
And there's no question about it at all. I think the trick for most people is you know, there are people who just love to exercise and exercise all the time. I work out several times a week. I think most, you know, most of my peers do. But I think for most people, the trick is to find a form of exercise that you will not find excruciatingly boring.
Right.
Because
that's
most people, when they think about exercise, if they go to the gym, they get on the elliptical or they get on the Stairmaster or whatever, and within a week, they're ready to shoot themselves in the head because they're bored to tears.
Right.
Yeah.
For some people, that might be swimming, which for other people is probably the single most boring form of exercise because you can't watch TV while you swim. You know, you can't watch the other people in the gym, whatever. You just got to find something that you enjoy. Some people, that's bicycling. For other people, that's walking.
That's really good advice. And we say that all the time. What's good for the heart is good for the brain, right? So diet and exercise, if it's good for your heart, it's good for your brain. All right. Drs. Jonathan Swartz and Mark Whaley, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.